Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter. And thank you, and this is Andrew Fetter with When Pigs Fly. It's been a great last few weeks. I've been through doing a lot of different things. As you may know, I've just did an event, a book signing event, and I had a glorious time in Oxnard, California, with my new book, Spirit. Those who are interested in what it is about going out of body, do check it out, andrewspirit.com. And I am also having an event if you are out in the Riverside area, in Riverside, California. That is going to be on Sunday, August 15th at noon at the Border Store at Riverside, 3615 Riverside Plaza Drive, Riverside. So hope to see y'all, whoever can get out there. I love meeting new people, especially the listeners who have heard me. Also, to let you know, be aware of, I believe it's on the 24th or 28th. Let me make sure that's right. Let me screw up on the times. It's the 28th of August. I am going to be in the San Diego area. It's going to be at the Border Store in Chula Vista at 8878 East Lake Parkway. And then, of course, it's Chula Vista. And I know I'm going to be at another one in San Diego, in the Grossmont area, but I will let you be posted on when that happens. I will also be doing several events back in Vegas and possibly in Santa Barbara as well. Anyway, I was hoping to have this present guest on a month ago, and we had some difficult times getting on. Apparently, some weird streaming. It must be that the subject of what it was, the science of it all, being quantum physics. But I have read his book a while back, and I don't normally do reviews. In fact, I almost absolutely don't do any reviews. His book, The Purpose Guided Universe, is extremely fascinating, and I highly recommend it. If he delves into bringing both spirituality within a scientific understanding, which I highly recommend. There is he makes a quote in there of a famous Sufi, Ibn Arabi, which really gets into the spiritual esoteric behind it, but I think there's more to it. When Ibn Arabi had once said, when the mystery of the oneness of the soul and the divine is revealed to you, you will understand that you are not other than God, for when you know yourself, your sense of limited identity vanishes, and you know that you and God are one and the same. And this is pretty much is in context of the esoteric side, but he outlays a very distinguished way of explanations, even through scientific and experimental and mathematical understandings. So without ado, I mean, I have to tell you, it's meeting of one's significant mind. I believe he's quite brilliant in what he lays out, and I'm very honored to have him as a guest. Dr. Bernard Ash, how are you doing today?
Fine. Glad to be here today.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I was sort of awed. I don't get awed too much, but I do get awed when somebody puts together such a piece of information. I read and see a lot of people put out all kinds of things, whether with it in science and when spiritual books and stuff. But your book was very poignant on dealing directly on issues between the quantum physics understandings with in relationship to the spiritual esoterics of shamanism. Since I've studied a lot of Kabbalah since God for over 30 years now, it is really amazing how it's almost identical, even in that is to, let's say, Taoism and other theology understandings, but it seems almost apparently identical to what science is starting to do a full circle and coming back to. But I have a couple of questions because people probably are not familiar with within your book and being dealing with the infinite understandings of certain experiments, which is in quantum physics. You mentioned one thing, understanding, which I've never seen anybody put this in there. I've heard it years and years ago, called the perennial philosophy. What is the perennial philosophy?
Well, the perennial philosophy is basically a summary of the esoteric, that is, the inward beliefs of all the world's religions. And Aldous Huxley, in 1945, published a book called The Perennial Philosophy, in which he went through the world's religions, and he came up with sayings and words of wisdom by the mystics and the teachers and the people who had transcendent experiences in all traditions, and found that, indeed, when it comes down to the basics, if you look below the surface, despite all of the contradictions religions have against each other, there's a commonality, and that commonality is called the perennial philosophy, the philosophy throughout the ages. And I found that book to be extremely valuable. But the problem is today, it's a little bit difficult to read. I mean, readers today generally don't have the patience to go through something as dense as Aldous Huxley's book. So I decided an excellent way to try to communicate these ideas is to write something that has a more modern context.
So what are the three tenets?
Well, they are that there is more to reality than simply the physical realm, and that we have the ability to know this, that we have the ability to know that there is more than simply the physical, and lastly, that we have a nature that actually is spiritual on that side, that we are dual nature creatures. We are creatures of both a physical body and spiritual creatures.
So now, how do these three aspects relate to in the quantum science understanding?
Well, we're discovering in quantum physics that it's really consciousness that makes things happen. You can't carry out any measurement. Well, I don't want to say any measurement, but there are critical measurements in quantum mechanics that can only be explained if consciousness is said to intervene, if consciousness is involved in the measurement process. And so, and we can talk about some of the paradoxical experiments in quantum mechanics that support this, but it's the role of consciousness in making reality real, making a measurement come out one way versus another, and resolving a measurement that is the key ingredient, because that's very different than what we experience in the ordinary everyday world. We think of the world as being something that's out there, that's separate from us.
And basically, the measurement that you're applying is the perception of a person, the observer, is that correct? That's what you're implying.
Let me give an example. This is a twins entanglement experiment, which is just a thought experiment because I'm talking about human twins, and so it doesn't really happen, but it's very analogous to what actually could be done at the quantum level. So let's say I'm a teacher, and I have these two twins, Joe and Jim, who are in my class. Now, Joe and Jim, unfortunately, live in separate households. They live on the opposite sides of town from each other, and they don't see each other or even talk to each other before they meet in a classroom in the morning. But I do an experiment with them every morning. I've got an index card that says, I've got actually four index cards, that say shirt, shoes, socks, or pants. Before the twins arrive, I choose one card at random, and this morning it says socks. Okay, so when the twins arrive in class, I look at them, and sure enough, they're wearing the same color socks. Now, they had no chance to communicate. They didn't know I was going to pick socks as the measurement, but sure enough, they wear the same color socks. So the next day, I do the same thing, pick a card. This time it says shirt. And that means when the twins arrive at my classroom, I'm going to look at them, and sure enough, they'll have the same shirt on without any way to communicate between themselves. This is a case of entanglement. Of course, it really can't be done with twins, but the very same thing can be done with photons, and it works exactly like this. And it's just totally non-intuitive that nature should behave this way, but it does.
So you're saying, by our measurement, our influence of what we want, our desire, I don't know how to put it, to see something to evolve or whatever to become the result is the measurement.
That's right. Our consciousness can choose what to measure, and what to measure turns out to be exactly what the quantum laws predict should happen.
But wouldn't be the measure chain can change at any, is based upon our own assumed perception? Because if we perceive, let's say, because we look at one point from a different. Let's say we look at a chair. There's a chair sitting there, and I'm looking at it from up, from looking down. So from my perception, I'm looking at that chair, looking down, so all I see is the arms. But now I have another person looking from up, looking up, and now they're measured looking at the chair, and they're thinking the same chair, but it's only got legs and it's got no arms. So it depends on where the person's perception, assumed perception of what they think that is reality. Wouldn't that be correct as well?
Well, that's a different kind of thing. In the case I'm talking about, the selection of the measurement you're going to make has one outcome happen rather than another. Not that's a different perception of the same outcome. It's actually one outcome versus another.
So you're talking about influence of the outcome.
That's right. I'm talking about the role of consciousness in making an outcome happen one way or another. For example, it's possible to put a single atom into two different boxes. One atom in two boxes. It sounds crazy, but it's possible to do this quantum mechanically. And you can then carry out a measurement, which consists of opening the box and looking in the box, or the boxes. Whichever box you look in, it's either going to be there or not be there. It's no longer going to be in both of them. So your measurement has made it be in one box or the other, whereas until you make a measurement, it's unresolved and it exists in both boxes simultaneously. It's quite a paradox, but again, these are measurements that have been done quantum mechanically for a long, long time. They're well established.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive, but it certainly shows that there's a role of consciousness that operates at the quantum level that's very different than we see consciousness operating at the macroscopic level, where it's really just it seems like just an inward thing that we have, whereas in quantum mechanics, it's something that really plays a decisive role in making the laws of physics work properly.
So you're saying our established thought creates the influence of what we're going to perceive to see.
That's right, and certainly that's true at the quantum level. And my point is that if that's true at the quantum level, then that suggests that at the macroscopic level too, consciousness plays a primary role. In fact, I would say that the choice one has to make philosophically is to ask whether consciousness is simply something that emerges out of matter, which is what most neuroscientists think, or whether consciousness is the primary stuff of reality, and it's really reality that's created by consciousness. As astrophysicist James Jean said back in the 20th century, early part of the 20th century, the universe begins to look more like a great thought than like a great machine.
So let me ask you this, since everything is basically made up of energy, is our thoughts are just basically energy?
I would say no. I would say that consciousness has created a reality in which we have two things. We have matter and we have energy that are perceived to be the stuff of reality. And I think, you know, our reality looks that way to us, but it's really all a product of a consciousness, a great consciousness that has thought this universe into existence.
So you're saying even from our own, we're already influencing our own measure by assuming there is energy in the first place.
Well, I think energy and matter are basically constructs of consciousness. That's a bit of a heretical idea, of course, because we look at things very differently from the scientific perspective. Science studies matter and energy. It does not really study consciousness in that context. But it seems to me that if you look at the perennial philosophy and the experiences that mystics have had throughout the ages, you find that it's not matter and energy that are the stuff of which everything is made. It's really consciousness that is at the root of everything.
So wait, what would be some, because there's, so it's some, we talk like in metaphysics about manifesting, creating. People's thoughts are produced like our reality, our things around us. So you're saying, because most esoterics look at the thoughts as being some sort of energy, something generated from you as a soul. That's like almost like a little ripple effect that's going out there. So you're saying that thought is not necessarily energy. It's only our consciousness that's created that understanding of that.
Well, I think there are energies we don't understand yet, and I think consciousness in the form of thoughts, which is pretty much the same thing, consciousness and thoughts are, I guess, kind of the same thing, that there are energies of some kind that are created by that process. I mean, I'm not talking about possibly the same energy we measure in the physics laboratory. I think there are energies that create reality that can be attributed directly to consciousness.
Would that be attributable to, like, dark energy?
I wouldn't want to hazard a guess on that, because dark energy is a recent discovery in astrophysics, and we have no idea what it is. And I'd hate to invoke that just because it's something we don't understand to explain something else we don't understand.
It's like, and yet it's like the whole universe is 90 is what dark energy.
Oh, 70% of it is.
Yeah, 70%. That's a lot. I mean, that's 3/4. And it's like the same subject of we don't know anything about antimatter either, or dark matter, from my understanding.
That's right. Dark matter is another 25%. That leaves only 5% of the universe that we understand.
Yeah, so that's not too much. And that 5% is only if you look at on a percentage, because who knows what else is we don't understand beyond that. But wouldn't that be sort of a measurement then? Wouldn't it by our looking at that way? It's like when you look at it the way you're saying, it's almost like going down the slippery slope of everything can be produced or assumed measurement is creating everything around us. So then even our own science, even what you're saying could be considered a measurement, the measurement on top of the measurement.
Well, yeah, I mean, at the level of the real world, we have 6 billion people with 6 billion consciousnesses, and we can't all create our own reality, but I think together we probably have shaped something that we call reality that we then analyze with physics and astrophysical measurements, and we construct this world around us as self-consistent, but I think the role of consciousness is a fundamental one.
So, but... Because this goes into the aspect, I guess, where I'm leaning into, which was amazing what you wrote up, people don't aware of. I think it was about Einstein. We all know about the curve in space. He was very much right on, but he had a problem dealing with the quantum physics, especially with Heisenberg's understanding of uncertainty. Can you elaborate on that, how he was trying to change... What he was trying to propose, and what turned out to be, he was later, I forgot the name, is Bohr, who showed that Einstein was incorrect.
Well, it goes back to the 1930s. Einstein was one of the early people who helped develop quantum mechanics, but he kind of soured on it because he really couldn't believe, for example, the example I just presented about the twins. Not exactly that, of course, but the analog of that experiment. He couldn't accept that quantum mechanics would behave that way. He thought there must be some reality that we're not measuring. There must be hidden variables that we simply are not aware of, and we assume that there is instead this fuzziness in nature that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle talks about. He just couldn't accept that, so he tried to disprove it. He thought he had disproven it in the late 1930s in a famous paper he wrote with Podolsky and Rosen, but as it turns out, Einstein was wrong. The universe really does operate in a way that is counterintuitive. It operates in a way that seemingly lets two things that are entangled with each other know what each other is doing, just like the twins. They're entangled in some fashion, and that means that they, in this example, will have the same shirts or the same shoes or the same socks on without knowing what the other person is doing. Yet, because they're entangled, they have to have that correlation. And that's the sort of thing that Einstein couldn't accept, and yet their experiments in quantum mechanics now that fully validate that, in fact, nature does have this uncertainty built into it.
So it's like he didn't like the universe could be made up of chance, the chance of possibility.
That's right. He said God does not play dice with the universe, and yet I think it does actually happen that way.
Isn't it that and that, because then, see, he would have... But then what does, see, because Einstein's approach he forgets there's a thing called free will. And free will is that, even on people, is that variable, like uncertainty.
One of the major results that Einstein brought to physics was the fact that the fastest anything can travel is the speed of light. And that means the fastest communication that can take place is the speed of light. And yet if you entangle two particles, you send them off in opposite directions, and you make a measurement on one, the other one has to flip into the proper state to correspond to its entangled relationship with the first one. And that happens instantaneously. Even if the particles are separated by light years, that information somehow is transmitted from one to the other instantaneously, or else there's something else going on that we don't understand. That something else, I think, is consciousness, because I think there are probably connections at a conscious level that are different than the connections we see in ordinary space-time physics, because that would simply violate special relativity, let the entangled particles communicate with each other faster than light, or instantaneously even.
Yeah, but so but the thing that seemed the very like what you're talking about, but on an application, let's say for the human consciousness who has free soul. I mean, like free will. I mean, that would be a variable of uncertainty because you don't know what the person's going to choose, or do you?
Well, I guess at the human level, yes, we have free will, but I'm saying
the thing with that, there's that you just, in your own experiment, it was like, let's say, and it's just the same because you had the twins, you already implied, let's say if that was in reality, that situation, those two twins didn't have free will, or did they?
Well,
they
in this case,
their
I
own
guess
thought.
The free will would not be at the level of the, I mean, in this case, the twins are playing the roles of particles. You know, I've used twins because these are twins. So in this case, no, the twins would not have any free will because they're playing the role of particles. The free will is the exercise that the teacher has of trying to decide what he's going to measure. So the teacher has free will to make a measurement, and then the particles, i.e., the twins, have to have conditions that correspond to that. So in that case, their will would not be free. It's the will of the measurement maker that counts.
So then the free will is would be the variable that even Einstein couldn't deal with.
I think that's correct, yes.
Because that would show there's uncertainty. So what about, let me ask you this, if, because in Kabbalism, we look at things in what they call the Ein Sof, or beyond the Ein, which is beyond the infinite. And so even in some aspects, when they refer to being beyond the infinite, which is beyond the nothingness, almost like, because it's sort of funny, because it's beyond infinity is nothingness. So, and that in itself is just, you know, being a concept, a metaphorical way of trying to say something. Because a lot of times in Kabbalism, they say, like, you don't know something, you sort of understand it, like you have an experience of it, because you can't not really know, because... And it seems almost like what you're saying, because like if you see what the universe is, you don't know what's exactly out there, but you know what it tastes like because if you experience it like tasting an apple, you've experienced certain things in your own perceptual way of whatever. Now my question is, since you have established a measurement of things, so is that... saying, so whatever we do within our life is based upon our measurement, and that's basically upon our experiences. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I don't entirely understand, but I fully agree with you that Kabbalah has some very interesting things to say about God. Is it envisions God? That is, a God is this thing that's beyond, as you said, it's a nothing beyond infinity, and it is everything. Everything simultaneously greater than infinity and less than zero. These are paradoxes that we simply can't understand, but that's what Kabbalah tells us is the reality, that we shouldn't try to understand certain things. We don't have the capability, but there is a transcendent reality that's out there. And that transcendent reality, I'm proposing, is the thing that thought our universe into existence.
Because, the problem is a lot of... see, it's sort of strange, because, like, the more the spiritually inclined, even in Islam, not I'm talking or regular Islam, but the Sufi Islam or esoteric in Christianity, or the core of Judaism, which is Kabbalism or Taoism or Native American spirituality, especially amongst the Hopi, they have a very commonality and of way of looking at things in a very infinite manner. But I see what has a lot of people have taken, especially in religious beliefs, they've personified God, and that's where they start from get-go wrong. They try to make it a he or a she or son of, or he cared about him or she cared about them, and they immediately place their own measurement of their own ego, let's say, because that ego would be a measure, wouldn't it, to apply toward their understanding of something, of our universe. And then, so they apply a human-like attitude, as opposed to what the reality of what you're trying to establish. It is more beyond than what we try to place our own images of or our own self.
Right. I think it's a big mistake to try to visualize God as being some real entity that exists somewhere. And if God existed in the universe, then who made the universe? If God exists in space and time, and who made space and time? We're not looking at the right level. And so I'm suggesting, as I think Kabbalah also
says, that it is space and time. God is space and is space and time. It's not indifferent.
I think that probably the creation of the universe came together with the creation of space and time, that they all came as a package deal, and that they were thought into existence by this entity, this thing, this intelligence that exists itself beyond space and time.
But wouldn't they be synonymous, the creation is the creator?
No, I think there's quite a distinction between the creation and the creator. I think that the creator had a motivation, is my guess, and that motivation, I suspect, is the one of seeking experience, to take infinite potential and transform some of that into experience, which is a creation.
So you're looking as there actually is somebody, something created the universe.
Yes.
So you're saying something created the universe, and but isn't the universe and the God that wants the same, one of the same?
No, I don't think so at all. I think the universe is a creation. It's something that I think is something God thought into existence for a purpose. That purpose being to seek to know itself through the experience that life forms can have in this universe. Now, not just us. I'm not talking about anything leading simply to man. I'm talking about all the life forms that exist on the planet and all the life forms that must exist elsewhere in the universe. These are all vehicles, I think, for this entity, this God, to experience some of his or its, let's just say his, it's really he, she, or its potential.
But aren't you now personifying a God by making it something that created something?
I don't think that's a personification, because I think that I'm attributing no human properties to it. I'm assuming, as Kabbalah does, that this God, this entity, is beyond our imagination.
But Kabbalah doesn't separate them. Kabbalah, they're one and they're part of the one and the same. Like everybody is God, of God, part of God. So I even read that one thing, that Surah, it's basically exactly the sense, even within Kabbalism. The Ein Sof is beyond, but we're all part of the same thing. We're all part of God. The creator of the universe and the creation of the universe are actually one and the same. There's like a, it's almost like, if you put it like in a quantum level from in, it'd be like saying, what's the difference between particle and wave?
Well, I don't agree, because in Kabbalah, the idea is that God chose for some reason to have a creation, and in doing so, he created this mystical void somewhere within himself. Within that void, there was an inflow of divine energy, divine light of some sort, and a creation took place. But that's a very separate thing from the being who decided, I'm going to create a void, I'm going to create the conditions so that let worlds arise. That is the creator and the created are different aspects of this.
So let me get back to you on the I tend to disagree, because that's actually in Kabbalism they're almost synonymous together. In fact, they call it more of a symbiotic concept. That's why you can't ever even divide those into those areas. That's why it's employed to look at, and even they use in the Sefirot, they talk about, that's why in the counting everything's so connected that it's one and the same. Both the void and the creation out of light, it's of the same. But but let me ask you this: in the quantum I understandings of what is the soul, what's established exactly within? What's the difference between a soul and a consciousness?
If you're asking within the context of quantum physics, I wouldn't know there, because.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's ever been thought through. I don't think there's any quantum physics yet existing that considers this at any kind of analytical level. So I wouldn't know how to answer that.
So they don't know what the difference is. So, like, do they know what the soul is?
No. I mean, soul is not even a concept that's recognized by science.
So they don't even, in science, they haven't even recognized a soul yet.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, definitely the idea of a soul is regarded as a supernatural thing and therefore primarily poo-pooed.
Oh, wow, really?
Yes.
So what happens when somebody dies, that 20 grams that disappears, that's just not taken into account?
When someone dies, in mainstream science, it's assumed that when someone dies, the body decays, and that's the end of the individual. It's a very bleak view.
Okay, let's say there was a consciousness. What happens to the consciousness then?
It's assumed that mainstream science has assumed that consciousness is nothing other than a product of the brain. Therefore, when the brain dies, the consciousness flickers out. That's the view.
Oh, so it's like when the battery dies.
When the battery dies, the toy stops operating.
And that's the end of the story.
That's the end of the story. It's a pretty bleak view of things.
Wow. And yet they don't know what dark energy or dark matter. Now let me ask you this: on what's the thoughts of then in relationship in quantum physics toward to understand what is our dreams and what is people who go out of body?
Well, the out of body experiences again are interpreted in a way that makes them be explained away. Out of body is just an illusion somehow that your brain has certain chemical states that trigger hallucinations, and it can't be real. Now, the problem with that is that people that have out of body experiences oftentimes see things from a perspective that they couldn't possibly see if their bodies were still, you know, lying in bed or wherever they are, and instead they have a perspective that allows them to gain information about the environment that couldn't be gotten from where their physical body is. That, too, is explained away. So, well, you know, these are misperceptions, these are dreams, and it's not ever tackled head-on how, you know, information that is verifiable could be obtained via the out-of-body experience. It's just, again, something that science prefers to overlook because it doesn't fit into the paradigm.
Because I've also heard some people of, not maybe mainstream scientists, but I've heard other scientists conjecture that the way a dream and going out of body is that it's basically going on to the antimatter side.
Oh, no, I've never heard that. I wouldn't even want to get into that because matter and antimatter are fierce foes. If you bring them together, they annihilate each other. So I would not want to bring antimatter into this. I see no reason to do that.
So it wouldn't be anything like, what would be your, from your view, what would your thinking be of that that element of what are dreams and what are, if you're looking from what your perspective of what you so far established what a consciousness is and the measure, then what would, under your understanding, what would be dreams and what would be going out of body?
I think they're probably different things. I think most dreams probably can be explained as the mind working through some events of your life or worries or happiness or other things that are part of your everyday life that somehow get reprocessed by the brain and give you this story at night. But I think the out-of-body experience is a real thing that implies that we are more than physical beings, that somehow we are a spirit entity. We are spirits who are associated with bodies. And under the right circumstances, the spirit can detach from the body and actually experience reality from the perspective of a spiritual nature. So when oftentimes it's said that the view is, when an out-of-body experience occurs, the view is from the ceiling of the room where you look down and you see yourself and you go, oh my God, you know, what is that body I see there? It's me. In that case, your spirit has separated from the body and your perception somehow, and I don't know how the perception happens because I don't see any eyes or ears or that sort of thing associated with spirit, but somehow the spirit perceives from a different perspective, from a different vantage point, reality. And that reality is sometimes verifiable in terms of being something that the consciousness, the spirit sees that wouldn't be visible from its body. So I think that gives the possibility of having some actual hard evidence that it's a real phenomenon.
See, because this is just so you know, because I've been doing this for about 20 years, just from my perspective of what, basically, dreaming and going out of body are actually pretty much actually the same thing. The dream is just you're unconsciously going out, and that's where people go sometimes into future state. They can actually, this is where it goes into, you can go back and forth in different time because there's no time sequence. And same thing when you go out of body, the same sort of the scenario happens. And what you're talking about, which is true because that's what basically happens so with me many times, is when you're out, there's a plethora of information out there, and then out of nowhere, you'll have this understanding. Like, sometimes I'll have understanding. I've never read a book, and I'll look in one page, and I know the whole book already because I've already been there through that book, and I've, in, like, feature form, almost read it or got that information from another source out there. Do you understand what I'm saying? This has actually happened to me on many, in fact, it'll blow, pretty much information from Zohar. I was in a class from a teacher of mine years back, and I had not clue of all the, I mean, I studied Zohar and the Book of Orot, which is the Books of Light, which are like a whole lot of journals, and what they call it, the Sefer Raziel, which is very in-depth, which is the Book of Raziel. And in them, you know, she'd be in class, and then she'd turn to me and go, "Hey, Andy, what do you think of this? And, like, how would this relate to, let's say, the Zohar?" And out of nowhere, I'd know this information. And it's like, because it's like I have going out information that's been, like, I don't know how she used to say, like, embedded into you. When you go out, it gets picked up and put into, she used to say, embedded into your bones, the way she put it. And it almost feels like that. Sometimes you have information that you've gone out, and it comes back to you. And it almost seems like the same thing Einstein used to say. He gets most of his memory. I think I'm paraphrasing, but I think he said something to the reflection that he used to get his understandings from his dreams, his casual daydreaming, his understandings. And so that means he's tapping into that other side. And that's what I feel that he was imposing. Because almost esoteric to do, whether it's through out of body, which in Kabbalah it's called the Merkava, other forms, whether it's Native Americans, they call it going stream walking or whatever, they tend to do a common thing, and that's going outside and pulling this information. So my question, see, I was trying to always figure out how to apply that into a scientific way of explanation, and yet it doesn't seem, and my only one was I thought maybe it was because when you're on the other side, time is not linear, but space is very one-dimensional.
I certainly had a lot of experience. I mean, I'm a bit envious because my knowledge of this comes from the intellect. I've read quite a bit, and I've done a lot of thinking about it. I don't have the experiences you're talking about. So that's a very valuable thing you have.
And that's why I was trying to explain, wondering, I was curious about how to establish it scientifically, as to what the soul is, because the soul is on the other side. It's more like almost like pure energy. That's why I almost feel like everything's energy. There's the commonality of energy. Thoughts are energy. Things are energy. And this is like when you're talking measurement. I put in a clue. See, in Kabbalism they call it the Tree of Life. People don't even know what the Tree of Life. A lot of people misinterpret. It's basically from the Kabbalistic understanding is that how we're all connected, da da da, but we're all leaves, and the leaves are representatives of souls looking at different perspectives, so we assume we're all looking at different things, yet we're really all connected, but we just have different perceptions. So we have different, what I was thinking, what you're implying in your book, the measurement, looking at things, and at that time, we make this wrong assumption of something that we see. And I think you call it the wave function collapse in your book. And so I go, wow, this is exactly how it was referred. There's a book called Orot that talks almost that refers to the same thing, something that when you see something, what you assumed was there is based upon what you think with your own eyes, because that's what you're experiencing at that time. You're making that assumed experience. So it almost refers to what you're trying to talk about with the collapse, wave function collapse, which I know my listeners are probably going, what the hell is he talking about?
Yeah.
First of all, could you explain, first of all, wave function and the wave function collapse, and then elaborate what I was trying to explain in relation to that souls and perspective. That's what I was trying to lead into.
All right, give it a try. But these things are difficult concepts. In fact, Richard Feynman, the brilliant physicist, once said, nobody understands quantum mechanics. And he meant that literally. He himself did not understand it. It's totally counterintuitive, and there's no way to understand it in terms of the paradigm that we have of everyday life. But the wave function, when I said earlier that an atom can be in two boxes at once, of course, you can't really have the whole atom be in two boxes. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's like a ball. A ball is going to be in one box or the other. However, at the quantum level, things aren't always all together like that as particles. They are also represented by a wave function, which is kind of a fuzzy representation of an object that's spread over space and time. Really spread over space, I guess. And so you can take that wave function, which is really, it is the atom, and yet it's not the atom. It's the atom in its sort of diffuse state. you can put half the wave function in one box and half in the other, and then when you decide to make a measurement to see which box the ball is in, you're not going to see a wave function anymore. The act of making that measurement is going to collapse the wave function, and you're going to make that ball be whole and complete in one box or the other. But the wave function is the thing that lets the particle be in more than one place at a time. But interestingly enough, the wave function is the particle. It really is. That's a point that's made over and over again in a book by Quantum Mechanics by a couple of physicists who wrote this one called The Quantum Enigma. So the atom and the wave function are the very same thing, and yet they behave very differently.
So it's basically at the point of measure, the timing of measure, or the timing of viewing something, changes the the result.
That's right. What you choose to measure, you're going to get an outcome that's consistent with what you choose to measure. But you have the freedom to choose what to measure, and that's where the enigma of quantum mechanics comes in. Because how is a particle going to know? He's going to make this measurement or that measurement.
So that, and here we go back again. So you're talking going back again. What we first talked to in the beginning of the show was a matter of choice. You're making that choice of where you're
what to measure,
which is a wave function. So, that's interesting. So then, now, because I always thought that was like almost like a measure. So if you choose to measure, I'm wondering how that would establish with if somebody was in that unconscious state. I guess you can't even elaborate get into something like that. That's probably why there's a problem of dealing that with how to figure out to understandings of dreams and going out of body, because it would be totally. How would you know whether it's part of it? Because when you go out, part of it, you bring in with you your own perspectives, your own fears, your own things with you. And that's one of the understandings is like when you go out, you are bringing your own measure, to speak. And that's why people, when they go out, they always say, you have to be aware of your fears, because that's definitely what you'll bring with you. So, on that point, but when you go, there's some states that you can go into that's beyond that state. Now, I give you a thing. Now, this is another. This is way out on left field for you. What is your understanding then? Because this is like I don't think science would say that. Oh, that's just manufactured out of chemicals or whatever of influences of guide energy, if you want to call it that, from the esoterics. Because all esoteric shamans across the board talk about a guide energy, an energy or source, whether it's angels or some wolf or who knows. Everybody has their own perception of something out there that on something spiritually helping, the little inner voice, whatever you want to call it, that helps, gives you advice or whatever, or helps you along in your dreams. That would be totally a non-touchable item then within quantum physics and sciences.
Yeah, I would say, frankly, science would say it's all a product of your imagination. It would simply dismiss it.
So then what is imagination then?
Well, imagination would be interpreted as some of the thoughts in your head that result from brain chemistry. It all comes down to brain chemistry. That's the reductionist materialist point of view that prevails these days in science. It has prevailed for some time.
But isn't that sort of this is where I have problems with our science today. It seems to me that in science, the methodologies of science are done in a finite methodology. Yet, it's already been shown that our universe is infinitely processed. So why would you apply an infinite method a finite method to an infinite reality?
I guess I don't know what you mean by infinitely processed.
Okay, if we have I'm made up a bunch of atoms and energy, okay,
mm-hmm.
And we don't even know that energy, and now we know there's dark energy, and there's who knows, and it's how small that is or what the space is, and they're saying 95% space or whatever, and you can go on and on. Everything's infinite. The reality of our universe, in fact, you just spoke about it, is everything's infinite. Right.
Well, no, actually, the universe itself is regarded as being finite. I mean, we can measure the distance of we know how far away the furthest thing is in the universe that we can see. So there's a certain size to the universe beyond which we beyond which it could be infinite, but the universe we can see is certainly finite.
When we do our measurement, it becomes finite. But in the reality, isn't everything really infinite?
I guess I don't know what that would mean.
If you're measuring from here to the moon, from the Earth to the moon, it's because we're making a measurement. We're trying to make, okay, this is this from here to there. But in reality, with the moon is made of so many atoms, and our space and everything is so infinite. In the reality of things, everything's more infinite, though.
Really, because infinite really is it's huge. I mean, infinite is infinite. And we know how many atoms there are on the moon. We can count those up. We know how far away the moon is. There's nothing infinite about the moon or its distance to us. I'm not aware of anything in science that's regarded as truly infinite.
So you're saying it's both finite and infinite?
No, I'm saying it's just finite.
Just finite?
Yeah.
So there's
nothing infinite about the moon, as far as I can tell.
Well, if you go down inside the atoms, you know how you count the atoms, but what about what's inside the atoms?
Well, inside the atoms, there are quarks, the particles that make up the atoms, and you could count those too. I mean, we know how many there are because we know the mass of the moon. And with the masses of the particles, we divide one by the other, and we can get a measurement.
Isn't there something even smaller than that?
Well, the smallest thing we know about are quarks. Whether there's anything smaller than that or not, I don't know. I mean, it's being searched for now at the Large Hadron Collider, other particles. But even if they're smaller, it's still not infinite. I mean, as long as the particle has a certain size, it's not infinite. It's not infinitely small. So no matter how small the particle is, if it's not infinitely small, then there's no infinity to deal with.
So you're saying now that it's everything, you can measure everything finite. Then what about you're talking about that input quantum physics is showing everything being more or less of, you know, it seems to be more like an infinite type of thing.
It's indeterminate. It's indeterminate, which is a different thing from infinite. Yeah, there's this uncertainty, but that uncertainty does not mean infinity. It just means that there's an uncertainty, a very important one, as expressed by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. That's not saying anything is infinite.
So what about how far the universe goes, how big the universe goes? That's the infinite part. How small is infinite, but then the actual measurement becomes finite.
We don't know about the universe. We know how far away the universe is from the last photon we could see. I mean, the furthest point in the universe that we can see, we know how far away that is. It's a certain distance. Now, what lies beyond that, we don't know, and we never can know, because any light coming to us from an object that's beyond the horizon, the Hubble horizon, will never be able to sort of outrun the expansion of the universe that's going in the opposite direction. And so there's a limit to how far we can see in the universe, and that limit is a certain finite number, which is well known. But beyond that, the universe may be finite but bigger, or it could possibly be infinite, but we just don't know.
So you're saying we don't know whether it's finite or infinite?
In the case of the universe, beyond the Hubble horizon, yes, that's what I'm saying.
And how small things are, that's sort of the same issue.
No, I mean, all the particles we've ever detected have a certain size.
But what we detected?
Pardon me?
The question is what we've been able to detect.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can always say that. I mean, there are always new things that we might run across, but we can't speculate about things we might run across because we have no evidence at all.
And what about, isn't there space within the atoms?
Well, we assume that space is everywhere. We assume that space is the fundamental stuff, sort of the arena within which everything exists. So, yeah.
But isn't space non-finite?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I mean, I would say there's a certain amount of space at every point in space. There's a certain amount of space within the entire universe. I don't see any evidence of anything infinite.
So on that side, everything has been purposely in a way. Oh, okay, I get you. So you're saying that is everything's in place and purpose order, but then you have that one quirk, which is the okay, on the other side of quantum physics is the question of free will, which is what you're trying to say, which is also the basically what God, well, no, I'm mixing up two things, but it's God is basically crazy things in organized fashion, but has its ability to, what's the word I'm trying to think of?
It has its uncertainty
of change, basically.
Well, what I'm suggesting is simply that there are certain laws of nature that turn out to make the universe a pretty friendly place for life. Because there are certain laws of nature and constants of nature that, if they were much different, would preclude the possibility of life arising. But in fact, life is in the universe. I'm suggesting that the reason that those laws are the way they are is because they were dreamed into existence by a great consciousness, which we might as well call God. And so it's the thoughts of that consciousness that make the laws of physics. And the rest follows naturally. The rest, including, by the way, Darwinian evolution, follows naturally.
Which means the possibility for things to be happen. But your own, like, I guess it would be the uncertainty part, the little question mark within the equation is, here's all the stuff, basic life that was made, the possibility that made life and things able to be, but then there's the question of human and consciousness producing the wave function, as you call it, or the collapse of the wave function and the measure. You understand what I'm saying?
I'm not totally sure what the question is.
Okay. So it seems almost like there's a duality, because you're talking of things of in one way of finite. You're talking one things of being things unlimited, and then you talk, it goes back again to things being measured, and but our own measure that we just did is based upon our own observer influence.
Okay.
Of the experiment. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that, yes, we have free will, and I think that's the essential ingredient in life, and that as free will, as beings with free will, when we carry out quantum experiments, we demonstrate that our consciousness is the thing that makes the measurements happen, that makes the measurements complete, which suggests that consciousness is the basis of all reality, that the universe really is more like a great thought than like a great machine.
Hmm. See, this goes back to where I'm trying to get to you, is my thing, this is just the way I feel. I feel that our science is limiting itself. Because our science has went into, we actually built our own walls.
That's quite likely, yes. We built our own reality. And I think we've locked ourselves scientifically into reality. It's kind of limited, and it's probably going to run out.
This is why I was trying to say to you. I feel that the universe is in different, multiple. If you look at the universe in an infinite capacity, and by the way, this is how it's looked. If you have a perspective of the universe in an infinite way, and this is what Kabbalism is, this is like the foundation within it, that you have to look at things in an infinite way, not a finite way, but infinite way. Then when you understand that the universe is really infinite, it's beyond the void, you can go down, as they say, with a rabbit's hole, as they say, both in space and time and all that, that when you go beyond the dimensional aspects that we created with our own minds, but the reality is there's more to it, then we remove those walls of looking at things like what you just said. We can measure the moon to this place, but in reality, we're still looking at things in a very Newton-like measurement, as opposed to we've built our own walls. And until those walls are broken apart and we start applying infinite approaches towards science, then things will have a greater understanding and actually a greater technology. I think that this is like in the same sequence, like in quantum physics, has broken the norm by its cracking the little ice, you know, breaking the glass ceiling, some people like to call it, and like what you're inferring of way of looking at things, and both in quantum physics, showing that things are more than like the measurements and how we're the observer, that sort of cracking that little things that there's more ways of what's our reality of situations of our universe. So that's what I was trying to get to. That's why I was trying to say, imply even the aspect of God, you know, the same thing. When God's looking to an infinite aspect, then you're looking at into the un. You can't really divide the creator from the creation, because that would be like almost we're building up again a wall, and that's actually the opposite. See, I always see things. If you look at things from a finite perspective, you're looking at the opposite side. When you look at things toward a infinite aspect, you're actually getting closer toward the truth. That's actually what it says even in Zohar, by the way, that term. It says when you go to the Ein Sof, you're heading toward the Emet, when you're going to, which is the truth. When you're going toward the finite aspect, you're heading to the non-truth, the illusion, which is what the measurement, what you're talking about. Anyway, that's what my thing was. That's why I was curious about how within quantum physics, it almost where they're breaking the ceilings. And I still feel that I guess we're still at grammar school.
Yep.
So, lastly, I know that we only got a couple minutes left. I know that in your perspective, from your understanding, it's really mean because didn't you study went through Catholic school or through?
Oh, when I was young, yeah, grade school, high school.
And how do you feel from where you are? Theologically and toward what you are as a scientist now?
Different than I was back then. I mean, I've sort of become an independent spiritual being, independent spiritual person. I don't really affiliate with any given religion. And I find myself applying the scientific logic that I'm aware of, that I know, that I work with every day, the scientific analysis tools. Try to apply those with an open mind to things that are beyond science, being aware of the fact that, you know, it's risky to do that because you don't have the hard evidence you do in science. But I think to overlook everything spiritual in the name of science is simply to believe in science as a religion of its own called scientism.
Now, how do other scientists physicists feel about what you presented within your book about God?
Well, I don't discuss that very much with them because most scientists don't like to talk about these things from a spiritual perspective. So I really haven't discussed this a great deal.
Well, the only one I can think of I've ever read is actually Einstein. So that, I guess, sort of tells it. I guess a lot of it. I mean, there may have been one or two others. I can't think of others. I think there are a couple. Didn't you mentioned somebody, I think, didn't you, in your book? I think you mentioned somebody. I can't remember. Ellington or something like that.
Sir Arthur Eddington.
Yeah, didn't he do that? He tried to get into the spiritual side within...
Yeah, he was very much a mystical person. He was a Quaker. He wrote a book called Science and the Unseen World. In addition to being the one who made Einstein famous, he wrote two textbooks, one of which talked about general relativity for the first time. The other one, which talked about the energy that powers the stars. He was a great astrophysicist, but he's also a mystic.
So he sort of... And that's where... And from that, you it seems like you looked upon and got a perspective of... Wait, maybe we should start looking toward this end? Is that how...
Well, I admire him a great deal.
I see. Well, you know what? Dr. Hesh, I'm just really... first of all, I guess I'm honored to have you on my show, first of all. And like I said, I feel your book is really very poignant. And I never read your other one, the God Theory, which I want to actually read. What do you propose you'll see within the near future of sciences, or do you have any understandings of what you think that will happen within the near future?
Well, I think the important thing is where the science can come to grips with consciousness as something that's not just a brain function, not just something that emerges from the chemistry of the brain, but it's something fundamental. I think that's the big paradigm shift that I hope will happen in this century.
It will change psychology.
Yeah, and I urge people to... By the way, if I may mention my website, thegodtheory.com, I would urge people to go there because both the books and the contents of the books are listed there and the preface of the books, and just a good place to go, thegodtheory.com.
And is there any way somebody can contact you? Is that through your website?
Through the website, yeah.
Wow. Well, all I can do, I appreciate you coming on my show. It's, this is very enlightening. You can go on and on. This is like taking classes here of
right.
The information that you have.
Right.
I know I've gone a little bit around circle some things, but Because it seems like in this subject, you can go very much in a round circle. Again, I want to thank you for coming on my show, Doctor. And with that, everybody, check out his book, The Purpose Guided Universe, Believing in Einstein, Darwin, and God, and check his website, godtheory.com. Thank you, and have a blessed week. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. And hang around Ruby Freeman.
I'm busier than you are, so don't expect a call. Everybody wants some, but no one gets it all. So I'm tired, I wonder, why am I afraid of it all? You cut the pain in half.